Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on a Monday, July the 12th, 2021, 7/12/21, 15 minutes past the hour, and we have got a great guest to kick off our program this morning. Now, our first guest will be on for the entire hour this morning, and he has written a great new book, which I just recently had the chance to read, The Division of Light and Power, a story of something that happened right here in Ohio, in Cleveland, just up the road. He is a former representative. He is a former Ohio Senate representative and mayor of Cleveland from 1977 to 1979. He also ran for president twice on the Democratic, or for the attempting to get the Democratic ticket. What a pleasure it is to welcome back to these microphones the author of this great new book, Representative Dennis Kucinich. Representative Kucinich, how are you?
Good morning, Scott. It's great to join with you and all of your listeners and friends in Marion, Ohio, and environs. And, you know, I'm always appreciative of the opportunity to talk with you, Scott. So I look forward to this discussion. I'm glad you read the book.
I did. I was fascinated by the book. Where did the I mean, we know what happened, but why did you decide to write this book?
Scott, I actually started to write it in November of 1979. And this, what the book that you've read represents the seventh draft that I've worked on over many decades. Now, when I was in Congress for 16 years, I set it aside. But after I left Congress in 2013, I began to pull the book together, and then in the last 3 years, I made an intensive effort to finish. You know, it's a 660-page book, and it's everything's very documented, and it's, I felt, was my responsibility to the reader, because it is a story about corporate espionage, sabotage, a mob-directed assassination, plots, bank extortion. It's, you know, there's never been a story quite like this told. And so it took a long time to put together, and when I finally finished it and the first copy arrived at my house, I will tell you, it was quite a feeling.
Mm. What do you hope the reader takes away from this when they're done?
Well, the book can be read on a number of different levels. First of all, I've been told by many people that it reads like a novel, except everything in it is true and documented. So it's a great book for a read. But for those who want to know more about what might be happening behind the scenes of government in, you know, in any community, this book is very instructive. It gives someone an insight that maybe they would have never had before. Because I bring the reader with me after my election as a member of city council at age 23, and I bring them right into the daily machinations of council, and then all the way through the story of the dirty tricks that were played against our municipal electric system, to the point of where I organized a campaign to block the sale of our system, which had been consummated. At that moment in the story is when a high-powered rifle shot misses my head by a fraction. And then the story goes into my election as mayor and what had happened with our continuing efforts to protect a municipal electric system that provided electricity at 20% savings as compared to the private utility. So the story, you know, as it unfolds, it gives the reader an insight into a government that maybe they never had before, and the kinds of things that go wrong, and why. I mean, government works. The question is, who's it working for?
The title, The Division of Light and Power, for somebody who might not understand what that means, what does it mean?
Well, it, you know, literally, it's the name of Muni Light, the department or division of Muni Light in the city of Cleveland at that time. Today, it's called Cleveland Public Power, but then it was known as Muni Light. And when you called Muni Light, they would answer the Division of Light and Power. It's also being run on another level, on a level of power and the exercise of power. And as compared to light, the light of truth, light in a spiritual sense. So people are seeing the title in a number of different ways, and I'm not disagreeing with any of their interpretations.
If we go back to the beginning, when did you realize this was an issue?
I would say when I found out that the utility, which then was the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, now it's part of First Senate, that the utility was lobbying the Cleveland City Council to try to stop council from appropriating money to make repairs on the generators of our municipal electric system. Now you think, why would they do that? Well, they did that because they had the private utility had determined they wanted to take over Muni Light. And it was easier to do that if Muni Light couldn't provide power to people. It's the fact that the Muni Light had generators made it easier for them to provide power at a savings. We made our own power. So they worked, the private company worked to undermine our public company. And I saw this with my own eyes as a young councilman. And I thought, this isn't right. And they were instrumental in blocking repairs. And they had members of council on their side through their lobbying and their influence, and they basically forced Muni Light to have to buy power from outside the city. They stopped Muni Light from accessing power from any place other than themselves, CEI, and then they tripled the cost of power and blew a hole in our municipal electric system's budget. So we couldn't generate power, and we couldn't buy it from anybody other than them. So, yeah, I mean, this was, I saw these dirty tricks going on inside. And you know, my antenna went up, and I said, there is something fundamentally wrong about the way this is being handled. And that piqued not only my curiosity, but caused me to go ever more deeper into the workings of the electric system and the finances of the electric system. And to follow what CEI, Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, was doing to damage the city's interests.
There are a lot of utilities in any city. Why was this such a big utility, such a big important issue in Cleveland at that time?
Part of it was, I think, ideological, but most of it was financial. I write in the book, I describe how CEI had built two nuclear power plants, and they were running into trouble with these nuclear power plants. There were cost overruns, and they had obligations to pay their loans off, but they weren't generating any power. These plants were initially neither used nor useful, so they were in trouble financially. They needed to expand their rate base, which means more customers, and so in the process, get rid of a competitor which provided cheaper electricity. Because if you get rid of a competitor that provides a 20% savings on a product, and then no one can, and we competed in a third of the city between Muni Light and CEI. If you can get rid of the competitor, then no one has any ability to make comparisons. And so once you take it over, there's at least in this case, 60,000 people whose rates would go up immediately, 20%, because it'd be the same rate as the CEI's. And then once that happened, CEI's record was pancaking rate increases one after another. Matter of fact, that's part of the opening of the book, the story about a drive-time radio host who was fired because he made an issue of CEI's rates. And they just had carte blanche because the Public Utilities Commission didn't really hold the rates in check. So yeah, I mean, this was really a case of they wanted Muni Lite because they had monopoly and they needed more customers and more revenue in order to pay off their rising debts on a nuclear power plant. So there was a lot at stake here.
You talk about the Drive Time radio host. Was there anybody else in Cleveland of any substantiation at that point who was able to speak out about this and keep their position or job?
No. Any journalist who started to venture into this question about the practices of the Cleveland Electric Aluminum Company was at risk. And it was well known. I mean, I knew there were several other instances that I did not mention in the book. The pressures that were put on writers who covered environmental beats, for example, and they were basically told, "You're not going to cover that story." And so what happened is that the book details four instances where three related directly to the utility, high-profile instances where people lost their jobs because they were inquiring into the activities of the utility, and then another one who ended up resigning because his station retracted a story which he had a dozen sources for about a bank that was involved in putting Cleveland into default that had determined that they were going to, early on, that they were going to try to use the city's credit as a weapon against me. And so, you know, this, again, the reader, people who read this, and I'm Scott, I'm sure this is your experience, too. You've never seen anything like it before. But the fact that it's documented makes it a compelling story. It's documented, by the way, with documents that came from an antitrust lawsuit where in the discovery phase, the Cleveland Electric Aluminum Company had to provide all their internal secrets, and so we knew what they were doing. But also, the Justice Department did a review as well and came up with the same facts, as did the Atomic Safety and Licensing Commission, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which required the first antitrust review preliminary to granting CEI a license to operate those nuclear power plants. So, you know, the documentation to the book is as thorough as one as any reader could ever want, and then more so.
Yeah, Representative Kucinich, just out of interest to me, and I know a lot of people, at this time, the late 1970s, early 1980s, probably the most well-known journalist in Cleveland, and maybe the state of Ohio at that time, was Dorothy Fulltime. And recently I saw an interview that she did with you on this subject from this time period. Do you remember anything about what the power company was going through with a big name like Dorothy Fulltime at that time?
Well, Dorothy, I loved her. I mean, she was called Cleveland's most distinguished news analyst and probably one of America's most distinguished news analysts. There were very few prominent Americans who were historical figures that Dorothy Fulton had not met or interviewed. Just an extraordinary woman who lived into her 90s and had a real command of things. Dorothy Fulton and I disagreed on Muni Lite. And, you know, and we went back and forth on it. But I always had complete trust in her integrity, and what a wonderful woman. I'll tell you, Scott, I felt she's one of the people who, in Cleveland's history, ought to be revered because of her command and knowledge of not just local events, but international and national events as well.
Absolutely. Would she have been somebody who the power company would have tried to lean on?
I don't think anybody could have leaned on Dorothy, but, you know, look, they were providing a steady stream of information to all the journalists and to all the editors and to all the owners of the media. And one of the scenes in the book, early on, I talk about how a secret document was put into my city council mail slot in a secure area, I might add, and somebody had given me an internal CEI document that detailed their plan to subvert the media to their own cause, which included forcing the sale of Muni Light and banking on nuclear power and some other critical environmental and energy issues. So, yeah, I mean, this book, you know, some people have told me it reads like a Robert Ludlum thriller or a James Patterson thriller. And, you know, all I sought to do was to tell the story as I experienced it. And it's, while I document everything, it's a very easy read for anyone who is looking for some insight into how government may work, particularly, you know, in a big city.
It's very interesting because as you read this book, I had this experience many times. I think, well, this I'm reading a book that is interesting, fascinating. It is an easy read. But then it dawns on you that this really happened about 2 hours from here.
Yes. And unfortunately, at the time, the media, which some of the editors knew it was happening, just chose to look the other way because of the great amount of advertising revenue that came in. I mean, it was actually, there was pressure brought on the Cleveland media from national media. This was getting coverage in the Los Angeles Times, in the Washington Post, and publications like the Village Voice, which then was very influential. And it wasn't getting covered in Cleveland, and it took years for the story to break out in Cleveland, only because one courageous reporter let it be known that he was reassigned from the utilities beat because CEI had complained that he wouldn't be fair in the coverage of the election on the question of Muni Light, and that set off a series of events at the Plain Dealer that resulted in the Plain Dealer being forced to cover a story that had been in for years about CEI's direct interference in our municipal electric system, including, by the way, documented accounts of CEI actually creating outages on the Muni Light system in order to facilitate their plan to take over public power in Cleveland. The kind of dirty tricks that went on, this is the sabotage that I spoke about, has never, there's been novels written about interference in government decisions. Chinatown, the movie, is such a story, but it deals with water, not electricity. But there's never been a true story that has emerged and documented quite like this, which is why I think is why it's getting critical acclaim not just for the writing but for the story itself.
Was there anybody in local government at that time in Cleveland who was an ally in this fight?
I'm sorry, was there anybody in local government that...
Who was an ally, who felt the same way you did, who had not been tainted by lobbying?
Well, I mentioned several people in the book who were instrumental. City Councilman, one named Ted Sliwa, who demanded an appraisal. Remember, the municipal electric system was being sold, this is before I became mayor, was sold without an appraisal. And no one even analyzed the price. Turned out it was being sold for a fraction of its true value. It was being sold for $88.1 million, and it was worth at least $250 million. So Councilman Sliwa forced that issue as chairman of Real Properties. Councilman James Bell was head of the Utilities Committee. He raised the issue about whether or not Muni Light was making a profit. And, you know, we had a few people who at critical times came forward to help us slow down the transfer of our municipal electric system to CEI. I mean, it was a battle royal, you know, and I take the reader through everything that happened, and there's a great amount of drama that unfolded over the electric system. And, you know, there's so many twists and turns of the system being sold and not being sold, being sold and not being sold, and the pivots and the feints go in a way that is could induce whiplash in the reader, but it's part of the thrill of reading the book, because you really see the kind of dirty dealings that go on behind the scenes in politics, and especially when it involves big money and big companies. You know, keep in mind, Scott, that Cleveland at that point was the number three corporate capital in America behind New York and Chicago. And it was also, at that point, the bombing capital of America, where the mob was engaged in a series of assassinations of, you know, mob leaders over control of loan sharking, gambling, prostitution, and other vice. So, you know, Cleveland was a cauldron of legitimate and illegitimate economic interests.
Is this something that could happen today? Could this happen in 2021?
Of course. I mean, it does happen. You know, there's powerful economic interest. We'll zero in on something that belongs to the people and just decide they're going to take it. Sometimes it's just tax dollars. Sometimes it's a physical facility. And I'll tell you, Scott, once the American Rescue Plan money runs out, cities are going to be looking for ways to supplement their budget. And one of those ways will be privatization of municipal facilities. So whether it's a waterworks or electric systems or sewers or bridges, roads, whatever, there'll be a whole new wave of privatizations coming up, which is why this book achieves ever more importance for citizens who need a guide as to how you fight back. So, yeah, it is very relevant today. This isn't just, well, the story is set in the past. If anything, the division of right and power is the prologue to more of the same going on in other places.
The title of the book is The Division of Light and Power. The author, Dennis J. Kucinich, former Representative Dennis Kucinich, is joining us this morning to discuss this great new book. Representative Kucinich, at the time, there is a lot, certainly in Ohio, even on the national level, being made of your age. What part did that play into this?
Well, look, I was elected mayor at age 31. I was the youngest big city mayor in the country. And I think that what part that played is that because I was young, I think that the utilities and banks that were involved in this probably felt that it would be a lot easier to be able to roll over someone who was 31 years old. I had 10 years of political experience before I became mayor, but still, I was 31 years old. And I think they guessed wrongly that I was an easy mark for their plans. And you know, of course, what they didn't know is that I grew up in the neighborhoods of the city with an understanding of the value of pennies. And I remember my parents counting their pennies to pay the electric bills. And when I was sitting in a room with the head of Cleveland Trust Bank, which at that point was one of the largest banks in America and certainly the largest bank in Ohio, and the head of Cleveland Trust was telling me, look, either you sell that electric system to CEI, which it turns out was a business partner of the bank, or we, the bank, will not renew the city's credit on loans that I hadn't even taken out. And, you know, I was in my early 30s, and at the same time, I was the mayor, and it was my obligation to protect the people's interests. And so I said no to that banker, and he decided he was not going to renew the city's loans. As a result, he put the city into default, and we ended up getting smeared. And, you know, I never knew I'd even have a chance at a political career again, because I just people did not understand why the city of Cleveland went into default. They couldn't understand that this was an attempted extortion on the part of a major bank. People didn't think in those terms then.
Was there ever a time where you thought, this is too much? I should give in.
No.
Never came up.
No. Was it packed with pressure? Oh my God, absolutely. But, I brought into public service, some would say an orneriness, others would say a steely resolve that I wasn't there for me. I was there for other people, and I had to take a stand. Sometimes you just have to take a stand. And what I tried to do, Scott, is the reader will follow. I did everything I could to try to work it out to avoid a fiscal default that the bank had contrived. I mean, I offered city property that would have easily covered the debt. We offered a whole range of possibilities to and plans to avoid going into default. But the problem is that the bank wanted only the sale of Muni Light as the precondition for financing the city's refinancing the city's credit. As I said, on loans I hadn't taken out. So I was not going to give them that light system just simply because they demanded that was the price of municipal peace. And unfortunately, the media never really covered the real story until years later. And, I will tell you that, the pressure was extraordinary.
What kind of pressure was there? Specifically, can you cite an example in your mind that was the height of pressure?
Yeah, I mean, the height of pressure came on December 15th, 1978. Brock Weir, chairman and CEO of Cleveland Trust Bank, I met with him and two other people in a conference room in Cleveland, at which he told me, look, I'll renew the city's credit if you sell Muni Light, and I'll give you another $50 million for the credit. You could do whatever you want with it in the city. You pave the streets in gold, whatever. And because the media in Cleveland at that point was in on pushing the sale, the pressure was coming from every level. The media was supporting the sale of Muni Light, and so they were communicating information to the people of Cleveland that suggested it should be sold. And so I was hearing from people in neighborhoods sell it, from radio, TV, newspapers sell it, the bank was telling me sell it, the council majority wanted me to sell it. And if I had done that, oh my gosh, I mean, I would have been seen as a hero. And when I didn't, I was seen as a zero. So yeah, that December 15th, 1978 was the day, and I give the reader an hour-by-hour account, so they're with me through this experience of this pressure cooker of politics and finance that was being put on me, and when I happened to be a very, very young mayor.
What would you identify as the turning point in your favor in this battle?
Well, I think it came when the plain dealer took off the utilities beat, a reporter by the name of Bob Holden, and plain dealer reporters stood up to their management and forced the plain dealer to cover the dirty tricks that CEI had committed against the city. That's when things started to turn. At least for the purposes of causing the people of Cleveland to support saving Muni Light. Now, that was back in 1979. For me personally, it didn't turn until 1993, November, when a plain dealer reporter wrote a story about the expansion of Cleveland's municipal electric system, which, of course, wouldn't have happened if I'd have sold. And that was the story. And at that point, people started to realize that I made a decision that was really important, saving hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes and utility rates for the people of Cleveland. And they realized then that I put my job on the line to stand up for the people. So that's when personally things started to change, setting the stage for my election to the state Senate and 2 years later to the U.S. Congress.
You spoke about the bullet going by your head. Now, this is a very pivotal moment, would be a pivotal moment for a lot of people. Can you tell us what happened there, why that happened?
Well, it happened coincident with my developing a public campaign to save our municipal electric system from the sale that was being transacted. And, it was pretty shocking. And, you know, the after I was elected mayor, the head of police intelligence came to me and said, you know, there is an active assassination plot, which then required, you know, me to take, you know, extraordinary precautions. And later on, I was told in further briefings that it was all about Muni Light. Ed Kovacic, the head of police intelligence, who I quote in the book, told me that, look, you're stopping some people from making a lot of money. They just want you out of the way. And so, you know, yeah, this story, it was a lot easier to write it than it was to live it, and it wasn't, and it wasn't that easy to write it.
Yeah. Well, when something like that happens, when a bullet goes by your head, when you're being told that there are active assassination plots against you, when you go home at night, what do you think?
I think about my soul. I think about the people I love. I think about, you know, you certainly think about life and how it could end, you know, at any time. And then you have to think about what you stand for. And if you believe the soul is eternal, as I do, you just realize that everything's in God's hands. It's not in yours. You know, there's this idea that if, you know, you're in public life and you can control things. Once, you know, I never kidded myself about that. I know there's some things you can't control. I couldn't control that. And I could just take precautions, that's all. And then the rest was up to God and up to me. So, you know, that's kind of the way I looked at it, Scott, you know.
In a situation like this entire story, what power does a mayor have?
Oh, tremendous power. I mean, the mayor in Cleveland, according to our charter, is, you know, patterned after the federal government, and the mayor is the chief executive and has the ability to be able to make things happen. You know, you can describe the policies of a city and actually, make recommendations to, send legislation into council for their approval. And, you know, you have as much power in a city as the president has in the country. So it's a very powerful position. Unless, of course, you turn the keys of the city over to somebody else, in which case you're just cutting a ribbon.
Mm. We're chatting with Dennis Kucinich, the author of a great new book, The Division of Light and Power. We have about 10 more minutes with former Representative Kucinich here, and it's a fascinating read. Representative Kucinich, was there ever a time when you were writing this book, and apparently over a long period of years, where something was hard to write about? Was there something that was hard to recount?
It was all hard to write about. I mean, I couldn't write it early on, Scott, because I was too close to it. You know, I tried many times early. You know, I tried right after I left office in November of 79 to start writing it. I couldn't do it. It was so traumatic an experience. And the reader will see that. You know, as the reader follows the story, they'll understand why, with the events that were coming at me from so many different directions, why I couldn't just sit down and write it. I had to sort it out. I'll tell you something, Scott, that I haven't shared with too many people, and that is that in 1981, I had a chance, there was an interest in doing a movie. And I met with a man who did Serpico, Marty Bregman, and Al Pacino, the actor, in New York City. We had a meeting that went about 4 hours, where we discussed, you know, every aspect of the story. I just had to write the story, and I couldn't do it. I mean, they needed me to tell, to just give the basics. I was too close to it. And so, you know, it was, you know, and so now here we are, 2021, was finally able to complete the story. And people can look at it with fresh eyes at events that happened and see why it's important today, because these kind of things are still going on, but people don't hear about it. And so this will give the reader some insight that might be very helpful to their community and to themselves as consumers and as citizens in a democracy, because ultimately this is a story about, you know, whether democracy prevails or whether, you know, big companies will just simply dictate policy to the government and get their way regardless of the impact it has on people's lives.
We talked about, in the physical sense, the assassination attempts, but they also went after you personally. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, after I left office, my academic background, I had bachelor's and master's degrees from Case Western Reserve. Case Western Reserve University. I was at one point honored as being one of the top graduates of the communications school. I had pretty close to a 4-point average in my major. I couldn't get a job in Cleveland, and any opportunities I had quickly dried up as the word circled in the business community that I, you know, might be hired to do one thing or another. And so, yeah, it was tough. I mean, you know, my wife and I almost lost our home. It came within just probably a payment or two of losing it, missed payment or two of losing it, and then the pressure was, you know, tremendous, and it was a pressure on the marriage as well. You know, anybody out there listening knows what happens, you know, when you're under extreme financial pressure in a home. You know, it's very challenging, and it could affect a marriage, and, you know, and it wasn't just that. I mean, when you think of everything else, pressure that was that my wife felt was extraordinary. No spouse should ever have to go through the kind of things that she went through, and it was very hard, no question about it.
You refer to this as a traumatic experience, certainly understandable. How did it change you?
I don't know that it did. I'm no less willing to take a stand, I'll tell you that. I think it actually made me stronger. It like tempered steel. You know, when you're in the cauldron, you know, it's either going to incinerate you or make you stronger. And it made me stronger. I mean, I cannot be bought. I can't be bossed. I paid the price. I've been through it. I can't be threatened. You know, and so what happens is you live life in a way that you feel like you can fly, you can float free, not, you know, it doesn't mean that I'm not aware of the ins and outs of every moment. But if anything, it made me more spiritual, because I really, you know, there's so much of the book that is about spiritual realism. It's about principles, spiritual principles that I was raised with and that I stuck by. And even though I paid a price, I wouldn't do it any other way. And so, short answer, made me stronger. Mm.
Is there anything about this event that you carry with you every day, that there's not a day that goes by that you don't think about a specific event?
In this sense, Scott, the spiritual imperative of every moment. When I was in the sixth grade at St. Aloysius Elementary School, our principal was Sister Leona, and she also had the sixth grade class. She stepped out of the room, told the children, read your books, I'll be back in a few minutes. She came back, the room was in an uproar. She was upset. She said, take out a pencil and a paper, and she wrote a poem on the board. And after we copied it, she said, you're going to take this home, you're going to write it 50 times tonight and come back tomorrow with it, which of course meant we'd be spending hours writing this poem out. And this poem really says a lot about the way I looked at every day and carried with me every day as a result of that experience in Cleveland. And here it is. It's called The Minute. I have only just a minute, only 60 seconds in it. Forced upon me, can't refuse it. Didn't seek it, didn't choose it, but it's up to me to use it. Give account if I abuse it. Heaven help me if I lose it. Just one tiny little minute, but eternity is in it. Mm. So, Scott, I believe there is such a thing as a soul, and I'm ever more aware that every moment has that kind of calculus, and to always be aware of the importance of every moment, that there is a spiritual implication to every moment.
With 3 minutes left here, Representative Kucinich, the book is certainly out, The Division of Light and Power. What an amazing read it is. Since you were on last, you have announced you're running for mayor of Cleveland again. The poem, the book, the event, all of that, how did that figure into this decision?
I live in Cleveland. The house that I'm in has been in for the better part of 50 years. I love this city. It's a different city than it was when I was mayor. It's almost half the size, and the level of poverty is severe. The level of crime is shocking. And, I love the community, and I'm in a position now where I have the knowledge and the experience and the energy and the willingness and desire to be of service again. So, yes, I'm running again for mayor of Cleveland.
What is the major issue for you right now?
Well, the major issue in Cleveland right now is crime.
Crime.
It's not even a close question. I mean, we have been called by some, studies that have shown us to be tied for the most violent city in America. The murders, the shootings, carjackings, felonious assaults, robberies, they're all going through the roof. Our neighborhoods, there are some of our neighborhoods in Cleveland where people are afraid to send their children out to play for fear of them getting shot. People are leery of going to gas stations in the city because of so many people having been shot at gas stations. And, there's a level of fear in some of our communities which is just not right, and it's got to be changed. And there are gangs that have taken over certain areas. So, the crime is by far the most serious matter, and I have said I'm going to deal with it by hiring 400 new police, 100 people who are, and plus another 100 that are experts in crisis intervention, where they can answer a call that doesn't require armed a gun, as a policeman would have. And I'm also want to create a civic peace department, which would look at the underlying cause of violence and really go very deep into what's happening in our neighborhoods and to get on top of crises before they erupt into violence. And so there are ways to deal with this. And, the last thing, what you cannot do is stick your head in the sand.
The book is The Division of Light and Power, the author, Dennis J. Kucinich. What is the end result of this book, Representative Kucinich? What is the story? Is it a happy ending? Is it trauma? Is it what can happen in city government? How do you see the story?
Well, I think it inevitably ends up being hopeful, because people see that it is possible to take a stand and survive, that it's possible to be able to change things, that it requires a certain amount of skill and luck. Life is worth living when you're willing to take a chance on occasion, and I did, over and over. And I just so the other part about it is the spiritual journey of being in public service. But all of us, whatever we do in our lives, we recognize that we're in a spiritual journey. And so the spiritual aspect of this book is very important, I feel, for people to see that it is possible to have a powerful position and not lose your way, not forget where you came from, not sell your soul.
Mm. I do want to remind everybody again, the book is The Division of Light and Power, and it really is a great read for any Ohioan or anybody beyond who is interested in this country. Representative Kucinich, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and I really look forward to our next conversation.
Scott, thanks, and you're a great interviewer. I want to say that. I feel like this is one of the best interviews I've done. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, we're going to break. Back in 15 minutes.
108th happy birthday to Billy Goat Charlie, who today celebrates 108 years old as the Cleveland Indians are pulling out of the Chicago Cubs in the World Series. Happy birthday, Billy Goat.
Happy birthday, Billy Goat, see you next year.
Do you think that the Chief Wahoo character will eventually end up in the same trouble